of a sudden cut out some reason.
Wow.
Someone doesn't want to be like them after all.
Fade out disappeared. Why? The gremlins have gotten to us. It was the evil anti-life equation or some such. I don't know. Was Ron Perlman. He did it.
He did everything else in comics. Yeah, that's it.
Anyway, this is Nuff Said. I'm Ed Menge.
I'm Ken Gale.
And our guest for tonight's show is...
Scott Roberts.
And that was Scott himself. And we'll be talking about what he does after Ed reads the news.
Yes, and here it is, the news for today, Monday, February 9th, 1998. We'll start off with the news that Christopher Orr has been chosen as the new executive director of the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. Or best known in the comics community as the director for the Small Press Expo. He'll assume the position and duties of executive director of the CBLDF on March 2nd. As executive director, Orr will administer all aspects of the fund and oversee its day-to-day operations. He'll coordinate requests for legal defense and act as liaison between defendants and counsel. He also will manage the fundraising efforts and act as its primary representative at comic and alternative press shows, including his own, I'm sure. they said they reviewed a lot of people, and it was amazing how many people actually wanted the position.
Good.
They felt with his background, he was the best candidate, and great for him, huh? And great for Comic Book Legal Defense Fund to have found a replacement for Susan Alton's position so quickly.
And I realize how glad I am that they didn't force themselves to have some weird acronym that spells something. CBLDF, you know, that's what it is.
And if you want to check out their official newsletter, Busted, their official newsletter or their website, you can go to www.cbldf.org for more news from them, and you can always make donations directly to them at Post Office Box 693, Northampton, Massachusetts, 01061. And in other related news, No Justice, No Peace, number 2, the follow-up to the last fall's anthology from Head Press is scheduled for July release. The first issue has now raised over $1,300 for the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. The tentative creative lineup includes Warren Ellis, Jeff Marriott, Mike Barron, Mike Leonard, and lots of other people. Mike Ludke says there's no problem finding people willing to contribute. Mm-hmm. In fact, with the second issue, he's received so many commitments that they're well on their way to having sufficient material to go ahead with issue 3, which will probably follow in the fall. Psycho Distribution has moved into a new warehouse. They've added additional staff, consolidated catalog operations from the West Coast, and added a state-of-the-art computer system, they say. Matt Blue, director of anime sales, says the last year we've grown way above our initial expectations. So they're really, I guess, doing very well in distributing comics.
Good.
Stuff that the others won't carry. The official Bardic Press website has been launched. If you want to go look at that, it's http://www.icomics.com/Bardic. From Mike Duran at the Newsarama at mania.com, we get these following news items. Awesome plans to launch Fighting American as an ongoing series.
Oh, lucky us.
With the team of Stephen Platt and Jim Starlin.
Jim Starlin,
The series will debut the week of July 4th, the same week as the new Captain America Sentinel of Liberty.
Oh, we have so much to celebrate in this country.
Yeah.
Walt Simonson has confirmed rumors that he will take over Jack Kirby's Fourth World as writer-artist when John Byrne leaves. And Bob Layton is leaving Acclaim after Dr. Tomorrow, issue number 11. This marks the last of the Valiant Heroes Universe 1 creators.
Yes, funny.
The old guard is
Yeah, I thought he was already gone. I didn't realize he was still there.
Well, he was gone as, art director or what was it? Was he?
He up was there the art director, creative director,
yeah. etc. But he was there right. still writing and drawing stuff for them. Anyway, what's he going to be doing? He's working on a 6-issue Charlton Heroes project with Dick Giordano, a 2-issue Batman Elseworlds story, and 12-page Silver Surfer story for Marvel's Shadows and Light.
Bob Layton has always been a big Charlton fan. I think that was his first pro work. So maybe he got his fanishness back for that. I don't know.
And here is what John Byrne says on his take on Spider-Man's origin. As you know, he's going to be doing the whatever they're going to be calling it.
Right, yes. The what if Spider-Man.
Spider-Man Year One.
Origin? Yeah, well, they're doing a what if Elseworlds combination at Marvel.
Oh, bully.
He says, my version of the original expands the whole accident considerably. It is no longer an open-air nuclear demonstration into which a spider happens to swing. It's a major accident in which things blow up.
Oh, boy.
And which Peter survives after weeks in the hospital only because of the bite of the spider. The realignment of his genetic structure does not happen almost instantly as it did the first time around. As to anyone getting the powers, it's been established several times that anyone but Peter would have died. He was very much in the right place at the right time. There is some reason for that as well, but I have some ideas in that direction, he says, but this is not the place. I'll be exploring them.
Heaven knows we're all disappointed with the way it was before.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, more explosions. Got to have explosions.
Okay, enough.
Yeah, what's a comic book without explosions?
Slow motion explosions with people jumping toward the camera.
Right, so, and outracing them.
Right.
Right.
Happens in everyday life.
I just saw that in Con Air about 20 times.
When I lit the stove tonight.
From Hell news, Kitchen Sink is to reprint sold out volumes of From Hell. They're going to repress volumes 4, 5, 8, 9, and 10. They'll be reprinted early in 98. Moore and Campbell are currently working on an epilogue to From Hell titled Dance of the Gull Catchers. It's tentatively scheduled for a late 98 release. And the film rights have already been optioned by New Line Cinema. They're currently developing From Hell in conjunction with JD Productions.
But it would be nice if something Alan Moore did for comics got onto film. It keeps getting optioned, but nothing ever gets filmed.
And
one of these days.
And that's it for my news.
And, well, I want to mention one bit of news. And I want to thank all of you listeners out there. Because I just found out this week from the head of our department that the best rated midnight show on WBAI is Nuff Said. And, of course, that couldn't happen without you guys listening. So I want to thank everybody for listening and pass along the fact that obviously you're not alone. So thanks a lot, everybody.
Got a lot of people tuning in to listen to this show, which is great.
Yeah.
We love it.
True believers.
And we have the same rating, whether it's at 12 or 12:30, so people don't come in and leave, or, you know, they don't come in late. So even though we're opposite Star Trek, people seem to, maybe they came Star Trek and listened to us, you know, which is only right.
Right.
But there's people who tape both, right? You know, you just put on a 120 tape at midnight and go to sleep and then listen to it in the car on the way home. Right, Alan? Right, David?
They're using both sides of the brain. They can take them in at the same time.
Yeah. But anyway, our guest tonight on Nuff Said here on WBAI-FM, that's 99.5 in New York, if you're just tuning in and wondering, people are talking about comic books?
Where am I? Is
Scott Roberts. And I had a lot of fun reading the Patty Cakes. They're just a lot of fun. Patty Cake is the name of the comic that Scott writes, pencils, inks, letters, and publishes.
Just basically sweats out.
Mm-hmm. And every once in a while I mention about how this is a great time and a bad time to be a comic fan, because there's never been as much good stuff coming out as there is now. And it's never been so hard to find good stuff as there is right now, which is why I say it's the best of times and the worst of times. Patty Cake is a great example of that. Great stuff that's coming out, and you can't find it anywhere.
Or, as Mark Hempel said in an early issue of Tug and Buster, why is it so hard to find comic books in comic book stores?
Patty Cake is a funny comic. There's so many people publishing comics, with babes, vampires, or guns. And, I guess you have a babe, but she's only 7.
Yeah, a little below babe-alicious age.
Yeah, I mean, they talk about guns, but nobody actually uses them.
There are no pinups for your wall.
So why are you so deviating from the norm there?
Well, because the norm is the norm, and I want it to be me, I guess. Interesting enough, the first issue of Patty Cake debuted the same month as the first issue of Stray Bullets, which had bullets in the title and a gun on the cover, and look how much better it sells.
Now, where did Patty Cake come from?
Well, that goes way, way back. I was a 9-year-old tyke, and like most of your child cartoonists or cartoonists-to-be, the tendency is to create hundreds of characters. Yeah, every day you're creating characters. Many of them stolen from other people's characters, and many...
When you're 9, yeah.
Yes. But once in a while, you just kind of hit upon something
or if you're
clicks.
Head of Awesome Entertainment.
Oh, well, you don't have to be 9 years old anymore. You have license to steal for life. But fighting American aside, this is not fighting Patty Cake. The name came first, actually. It occurred to me that Patty Cake Baker Man would be a good name for a character. My number one love at the time was Peanuts, and I wanted to grow up to be Charles Schultz, but I kind of figured the job was taken. It was filled, so I
had... Ice skate as well as him anyway.
Right, and I don't own my own rink. But I had to have some character like that. So, actually, I sent my Christmas issue out to Charles Schultz recently, and he appeared to like it. I talked to him on the phone the other day, and he
cool.
Oh, he's a wonderful guy. Very, very casual, laid back. It has not gone to his head, people. He has been the most successful cartoonist in history that I can think of, and he is unspoiled.
That's nice to know.
So he's, it was a rewarding conversation, and of course I had to steel my nerve up for doing that, but nonetheless, getting back to where Patty Cake came from, the name occurred to me, and I got excited, so I sketched her down. I believe, as I remember the incident, I was standing in the closet looking for something or other, and I ran out to get a piece of paper, get a pencil, and just drew it standing there at the dresser, and I wish I could find that first drawing. I don't know where it might be, or if I could identify it. I've printed or published in the book many old drawings I did of Patty Cake as a kid, but where the first one is, who knows? But she clicked right away. I knew this character was better than a lot of my other characters, and she'd last.
And do you create all the characters in Patty Cake? Do you create them first and then put a story around them, or do you create the story first and find an event characters to fit the story?
It can really work both ways. Like Patty Cake herself and her friend Jose, they go way back. Jose came along about a year after Patty Cake. And other characters who came along over the years are Unnerving Irving. He came along about in 1983 when he was in my 20s. And Mr. Cuddles, the man who lives on the street, one of the neighbors, he goes way back to my childhood, actually. So I had a core group of characters set and ready to go, and I had to find a book that would fit them. Other characters have popped up in the series as I went along and as I needed a certain role. Like Susie McBee, for instance, who is Patty Cake's chief nemesis, came along around issue 7 just because I had a story where I needed a nemesis for Patty Cake. I think she's kind of clicked because she continues to reappear since then. In fact, she's in the story I'm writing right now, which will be Slave Labor number 8. I'm published by Slave Labor Comics now, so if all goes well and people keep buying the book, there will be a Slave Labor number 8, and you'll see that one.
It's funny, the only influence you've mentioned so far is Charles Schultz, but Patty Cake is nothing like really any of the characters, with the possible exception of Lucy, but she's much more Dennis the Menace or Calvin than anybody in Peanuts.
Well, if I have to boil it down to 2 primary influences, because really you could sit there and list all the things that have influenced me over the years and it would take the whole show, but the 2 primary things that it spins on would be Peanuts and Mad Magazine, if you could lump the 2 of them together. The idea of doing something with kid characters like that, because I think even as a kid I recognized what was special in Peanuts was that the characters had real, believable personalities. They were distinctive. You knew who each one was, and that I wanted to do. the level of the humor, the crazy exaggeration, the, you know, the fact that the kids blow their stacks mm-hmm. in here and do all the contorted expressions, that kind of comes from that mad background.
So it doesn't come from Tex Avery, Chuck
Jones? Tex Avery, too. Oh, yeah. I grew up on a steady diet of television animation.
Because, I mean, that's the first thing I thought of while looking at the artwork, is that this is obviously from animation rather than from comic books.
Oh, yeah. When I was very young, preschool age, my brother and I used to get up, crack of dawn before our parents, and we would watch these cartoons that fascinated us. In retrospect, I believe they're the Paul Terry Aesop's Fables, some of the earliest cartoons ever made. And they were, you know, no dialogue and anything. They were silent cartoons originally, and they put this redundant music to them, and it was just like one after another, and they were just the most violent little cat and mouse cartoons. looked rather like, you know, the same style as Chris Ware's Quimby the Mouse kind of thing. These little black and white cat and mice things. Uh-huh. And from there, we just, the diet of cartoons began. There were the George Pal Puppetoons, the Looney Tunes, Warner Brothers, Hanna-Barbera, all of them.
Well, why did it take so long for you to start doing comics? I mean, the independent comics have been around since the early 80s, and you didn't really start till 94.
Well, it was an awareness thing, really, because my awareness of independent comics for years had been mostly the underground comics. I was a little slow catching on that there's such a thing as self-publishing. That dawned on me, really, when I discovered Bone. I spent most of the 70s and 80s trying to sell a comic strip, magazine cartoons, and just not denting that market.
You were trying to sell to newspaper syndicates?
Yeah, and often it involved either Patty Cake herself or some other comic strip in which she would inevitably appear as a supporting character, because she kept bouncing back to almost everything I did. But about 91, 92, I started thinking more about comic books and exploring the comic shops and seeing what was out there and discovering all kinds of things I'd never seen before. And, you know, it was mostly the small press, black and white.
Did you stop reading comics somewhere in there?
I never really stopped. It's just what was reaching me, because I hadn't looked at a mainstream superhero comic since I was a kid. My older brother was a big DC collector. He bought almost anything with Superman on the cover. And about the only thing I bought myself with my own money in that genre would have been Batman. Otherwise, I bought humor comics. I was big on Dennis the Menace, the old Del Peanuts comics, Little Lulu, but that was reprints by the time I was buying comics, so that's...
You just linked in with last week's show, too.
Okay. Good enough. But that's where I think where I first picked up the phrase, reprinted by popular demand. I used to see that. I would just get the picture of people outside offices saying, we demand, you know, we have to see this story again and stop printing this new junk. But... my younger brother had a big collection of undergrounds, and I borrowed them, started looking through them, you know, Freak Brothers and all that good stuff. But when I hit Bone, first I just assumed it was coming from another, you know, established publisher. And then the more I looked at it and read, you know, about it, I realized this guy's doing it himself. He's putting up his own money, putting his own logo on it. And I started learning about that. And I started, you know, studying whatever he did and reading all the interviews with Jeff and... saying, well, you can do this. You can actually bypass the whole system of editors naysaying your work and just put it out there in the market and get a direct response. So that's...
Well, do you have anybody editing you? Somebody who looks at your work before you get it printed?
Not really, no. So far, everything that you've seen inside the book is pretty much what I put in there. In fact, Dan Vado's policy at Slave Labor is he's very much more concerned with the outside of the book, the packaging. It was his suggestion to change the approach to the covers, change the logo. And his feeling was that the old covers were a little traditional and soft-looking and probably were not representing to new readers what was inside the book. So it's okay, I'm flexible, I will try that. He sent me some samples of what he thought a new logo could look like, and I based the design on what he sent me. And he just kind of turned me loose to come up with new cover designs based on... you know, make them zippy, make them funnier. You know, and I send them a bunch
of
stuff.
Now, another humor publisher once told me that everybody wants to read humor comics, but nobody wants to buy them. Has that been your experience? Yeah. You're at every Big AppleCon, and you'll be there next week, I assume.
Yes, I'll be there.
The Big Apple Convention is at the church that's on Columbus between 59th and 60th.
St. Paul the Apostle Church. Yes.
And it's in the basement of the church there between 10 a.m. and what, about 5 or 6 p.m.
It's about 6,
yeah. Yeah. And there's a lot of independent folks there. And, of course, Scott's there all the time. And Dan Reed, who's our guest about a month ago.
Yeah, sit there even after it closes and wait for the next one to open. They keep sweeping around me.
Ed and I will be there this weekend taping somebody or other. But, I mean, have you found that people want to look at it, but they don't want to actually give you money?
Yeah, I've heard that bit of wisdom from columnists in the Comics Press and from other cartoonists doing humor comics. It's a weird prejudice. I don't know where it comes from, but people sometimes just seem to be slower to plunk down their money on something that's not going to promise them escapist adventure and, you know, sexy babes with big, you know, things, which, you know. I'm not
with big guns.
Yes, right. Bad girls with big guns.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that it's when you look at Patty Cake, all you know what you see is a cartoony looking comic, and it is something you have to read in order to appreciate. And I also found that it was something that you have to read really a couple issues to appreciate. The first issue all by itself, before you get to know the characters, it's like, you know, oh, okay, you know, it's a neat comic. But I quickly got into it, much faster than most serious comics, really.
Well, the first issue was a little different because it's introducing the characters, so I went more for slam-bang pacing. The very first story in the first issue was just very fast-paced. First time I showed it to my mother, who... is, you know, see my work all the years I was growing up, her first reaction was, this thing is giving me a headache. Because, you know, it's just yelling and screaming going on. Basically, for anybody who hasn't seen it yet, a quick overview, Patty Cake sees a monster truck on television, becomes obsessed with this idea. I mean, kids like things that are big and noisy and stupid and because of...
Are you saying monster trucks are stupid?
Heavens, no. Oh. I wouldn't say that. But to a kid, it's cool. This would impress every kid in the neighborhood if we had a monster truck. Of course, her father says immediately, no, we're not getting a monster truck. Don't be silly. So she goes out and lies and tells all the kids in the neighborhood they're going to get one.
And all the kids believe her.
Right. Assuming that if everybody thinks he's going to do it, he's going to feel compelled to do it. And, of course, he lays down the law. No, he's not going to do it. But, you know, she learns no lesson from that. And the next day she's telling more lies. And, of course, Gullible Irving hasn't learned not to believe her. But
well, Gullible Irving's only 5.
Right.
And she's an older woman. She's 7. So,
right,
of course.
So she leads him around by his little pug nose. But that's the kind of pacing I wanted in the first issue. Just to grab people, to get attention. Mm-hmm. And then the second issue, you know, you get a little more into their personalities and the interplay. And
do you script for yourself?
You mean ahead of time?
Yeah. No. I mean, no, do you script the story and then draw it, or do you sort of do
it? Everything happens really at once. I just, you know, I take the paper that is eventually going to appear on the actual finished paper. I just sit down with a pencil, and I script and rough pencil as all one process.
So you sort of outline it in your head, and then you put it to paper?
Yeah, I'll carry a basic story premise around in my head, and I'll just kind of kick the dialogue around in my head and ideas for scenes within the story. Occasionally, I'll have...
You do this all before you start to draw?
Well, it can vary from story to story. Of the longer stories, I'll work out in great detail in my head, but I don't put anything on paper. The only time I put anything on paper ahead of time is if I'm away from home, I'm driving, and I just get a little bit of conversation. I don't want to forget it, and I'll just quickly jot it down. But you know, as far as actual scripting, some stories, I'll only have a premise, like Patty Cake and Irving are going to put a penny on the tracks. That's the whole premise, and I'll just sit and make up the rest as I go along. I want that kind of spontaneity.
Do you do a lot of changing when you do the final inking?
Oh, yeah. The dialogue will change. That's my chance to edit and revise. I may add all those little extra word balloons, especially Irving, because he says a million things, you know, and, you know, a little short two-word sentences right and left. And you tighten it and revise it. I don't change the drawings much from the loose pencils. Those are pretty much an accurate guide of what I'm going to do. It just gets incredibly tighter because I put her face in, but her body is like a circle for the body and little loops for feet. And, you know, I know what they look like, so I'll...
Right. So you don't pencil in great detail for yourself?
No, I don't really do tight penciling on most things unless it's something that's unusual. It's not in every story, and I really want to know what this is going to look like, so...
Now, you've got a pretty complete world for Patty. She's got a bunch of friends. She's got neighbors. She has teachers. She has, relatives. Yeah, is that something that you've been creating as you go along, or did you all make them up, when you were a kid in the 60s?
Well, it's been built since then, bit by bit, adding things. There is an entire world that she's a part of. I spent most of the 80s trying to sell a comic strip that was based around my character, Mr. Cuddles, who also appears in the book as a secondary character. But he's sort of a linchpin character because it can go off in all directions around him. He was the center of the comic strip because all these other characters radiated out around mm-hmm. him and his adult son. And then at one point, I even split that into three separate comic strips. So there's this entire community of characters, and many who've never appeared in Patty Cake yet, but they still exist within that reality to me. And the more backstory you have, the more you know about your characters' mm-hmm. backgrounds, the better you can write them. Because
sure.
Even if you know characters that they know who have never... Actually, if you read the series straight through, you'll see people who are referred to in one issue, and they don't ever appear until like 5-6 issues later.
Right.
I'll already have dropped their name in and said things about them. The local bully, Kevin Longo, he was mentioned a few times before he really showed up and started doing anything.
I'm thinking of, when you're talking about, failed sales of strips. I mean, Spaceman Spiff and Calvin Hobbes was a comic strip that he created that didn't work. You don't throw away ideas, you just sort of, toss them.
Actually, he turned down the opportunity to do a strip in which he would have been handed somebody else's idea, too.
Mm-hmm.
He was already to be picked up by another syndicate that said, we'll only take you if you'll put this character Robot Man in your strip. And, of course, he said, no, I don't want to do somebody else's character. And this was a merchandising thing. It was a toy from England that they were trying to turn into a strip here. And they said, well, no deal. So he went elsewhere, and they got somebody else to do Robot Man, and where is he now?
Yeah, right.
But, you stick to your guns, and you keep an integrity to your creation because you know what it is, and, you don't have somebody slotting in their ideas because this will sell well.
Now, you don't have any kids of your own, but you have very accurate kids in Patty Cake. Are there kids who are inspirations?
Yeah, well, nobody is...
Nieces, cousins?
Just the kids I grew up with, really. Nobody is directly ripped off from one particular person. It's all kind of composite. I mean, Patty Cake herself is obviously a little girl, and I was obviously a little boy, so that's a safety valve to keep the book from wallowing in autobiography.
Uh-huh.
I'm afraid if she were a little boy, I'd start writing it so much about me that, it'd become another one of those autobiographical books, whereas with Patty Cake, I just imprint something that happened to me.
Yeah, but you couldn't have been thinking that when you were 9 years old.
No.
When you created
You don't think that kind of stuff. You're just trying to think of neat characters then. This is the way you look at it now, and I realized, she's arbitrarily a girl because the name came first, but also she lasted longer than a lot of other characters I made up. I made up other little boy characters, and, where are they? They didn't work out. Jose's the only one who stuck, and he's still a secondary character to Patty Cake.
So all the characters are loosely based on people from your memory rather than people that you know now.
Well, I grew up in an ideal neighborhood for writing a book like this because it was one of those post-war neighborhoods, suburbia, and it was just full of kids. So many of the parents were, the fathers were returning.
That's why they call it the baby boom.
Right. We were in the baby boom. I was on the last wave of the baby boom. My dad was one of the last World War II vets, and there were a lot of Korean War vets, and it's just that kind of neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So many kids your age. And you can just think of all these things that you did or they did or confrontations you had with some kid. You say, well, that's a good story. I'll store that in my mental file. Uh-huh. Well, I do keep a list on disk in my word processor things. I don't have a computer, but I do have a little word processor. And that's just like one-line descriptions of possible stories.
You have enough Patty Cake to last you for a long time, I bet.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I got a lot of things I could spin issues off of.
Ed's got to have a pile of Patty Cakes next to me, and Ed just grabbed them. He's getting into it.
Well, he's also got one copy of the other book I'm working on currently, Tales from the Bog by Marcus Lusk, from Birmingham, Alabama. Excellent comic. I think one of the finest on the market. I was attracted to it when I first met Marcus at a convention.
Uh-huh.
We were at a convention up in Vermont, and he was across from me, and he didn't even have the book out yet. He just had ash cans, but he had original art on the wall, and I wanted to go over and ask him questions, because, this looks interesting. This is different. this guy is not trying to be like something. And he was a big Marvel fan, big Kirby fan. But he knew enough not to just go in there and copy somebody else's book and do his cheap imitation. But as I got to be good friends with Marcus, I ended up working on the book with
him. Now, give everybody the address and where they can get patty cake if they can't. If they can't make the Big Apple Con next week, where can they get it?
Well, they can always write to Post Office Box 546 in Muncie, New York, and that is spelled M-O-N-S-E-Y. And I'm not sure the
name. And the zip code?
It's 10952. I can't guarantee the pronunciation of it, but if you're writing, you don't care how it's pronounced.
And you'll be at the Ramapo Convention, which is right near Muncie, New York.
I will be at the Ramapo Convention May 16th. I believe that is the date, Saturday, May 16th in Spring Valley.
That's the convention that Ed and I basically talk about for the entire year, because it's a convention with about 200 guests and about 300 fans attending, so you get to really spend time.
And if you're in the New York City area, it's extra easy to get to. If you're in the city itself, all you got to do is get on the Palisades Parkway and head up to the Spring Valley exit.
Or take the red and tan lines.
You can do that, too. If you happen to have your own wheels, they'll drive up the parkway to Spring Valley, and sooner or later you're going to get to Viola Road, where the high school is, and that's where the
It's a great convention.
It's a friendly, user-friendly con. You can actually talk to people there and hear.
Now he helps run both Ramapo and the Big Apple cons, but what's Alan Rosenberg really like?
Alan Rosenberg is a very enthusiastic supporter of comics. He got me involved in
Gossip. Never mind this.
Well, he's actually he's a bank robber. He's he's on the lam right now, in fact. No. Now, Alan is just
he's a fan.
Bad things can I say about Alan? No. Now, Alan's a good guy because, he's done a lot to support me. Not support me financially, but promote me and push the book and push anything he believes in, really.
Yeah.
He's very supportive of small press. He discovered the book in the local shop, found out I was local, invited me to his con, gave me the name of somebody who ran another con, and one thing led to another, and I kept meeting other people who ran other cons and meeting other cartoonists. And
how it starts,
He's been a real linchpin in that way. And so he's been, besides being an enthusiastic supporter, he's become a good friend, too. So, I talk to Alan quite regularly now, and he always calls me when the new issue's out to tell me what he thinks.
Well, let's talk about the publishing part doing Patty Cake. Let's talk about distribution, getting the comic out there.
That gets a little weirder every year. Well, when I first got into it, I was going with a lot of old, outdated information. When I started, I had a list of all the distributors, and it was like 10 or 20 distributors. And I thought, that's a lot of them. I'll send packages with this comic to, I'll start with four. I'll pick four in different areas, and that'll cover my bases, because I didn't know what it was doing. Diamond was the only one I'd heard of. I knew them. Mm-hmm. I knew that name. I sent a package out to one out in Kansas called Action Direct. They were already out of business. Styx in England, they were already part of Diamond. And I believe Andromeda up in Canada, they loved it. They were going to carry it, and they went out of business. So it took a couple issues before I got it into Capital, and now they're gone. So it's kind of winnowed down. It's now carried by Diamond, FM, Cold Cut, of course, has the back issues. Cold Cut is your source for back issues of books and that sort of thing.
Great source.
Yes. And they, every so often they contact me for another supply of patty cakes. And I get their catalog and see what else they got. Because I've gotten a few things that I couldn't find anywhere else. I got my Mad Raccoons through Cold Cut, which unfortunately seems to come out about once a year. But, you get your Mad Raccoons fix and you got to see it again. So that's really what happened was the entire continental shift began about the time I joined. In fact, Marcus and I were on the road going back up to Vermont to do an in-store signing the weekend of the buyout. We stopped in Massachusetts and called ahead and said, we're on our way, and we were told, we got some big news this weekend. Do you want us to tell you now or wait until we get here? Said, don't tell us there's big news and make us wait. What? Diamond bought Capital. And we heard it at a gas station on a payphone. That's where we got that handed to us. And
how important is coming out regularly?
Well, I think it's very important because it keeps your presence in the market, because how often have we all been frustrated by that book we love that never seems to appear? Mm-hmm. And you wait, and you wait, and where's the new issue, and is there a new issue, and did another one give up and collapse? I mean, I have a list of favorite comics I follow, and, you know, some, they're like clockwork. Thieves and Kings, every month it's there, or every 2 months.
Now, where do you step on the line for, you know, how much money you're going to lose or not gain and putting it out anyway?
Well, you accept that you're just going to lose money, I guess. That's all you do in this business now is you lose money. You don't make money. You just... Basically, I lost a lot of money self-publishing and trying to keep it coming out regularly. Mm-hmm. It was so important to me to be regular that I was just financing the thing right out of... I don't know where the money was coming from, but it was just going. And it got to the crisis point where I knew I couldn't do it for much longer. I actually got 9 issues out. For a book that hasn't made a whole lot of money yet, the fact that there are now 17 issues says something. I think that's pretty good batting average. I did the 9 myself. We had 4 from Caliber's Tapestry. And now 4 so far from Slave Labor, but it's still an ongoing series of Slave Labor.
How did you end up at Caliber?
I was invited, actually. I'd been out to the Motor City Con, and that weekend I already knew that I was fishing around. Could somebody else kind of help me out here? I'd, you know, approached a couple of people. The connection at the time, actually, Steve Lieber came by the table and said, you know who you ought to try? He said, you know, you got to try Caliber. I know some of the people there. So he took some material over to them, showed that to them. And, well, as it turned out, Gary had already heard of the book because he also retails. Gary Reed is the head of Caliber, of course, if you don't know that. And if you did, it's just been reinforced for you. But he retails and he carries the book, and his kids like the book, too. But the day after I got home from the con, he called me and he told me what they were up to, that they were starting this new line.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't even named yet. It wasn't even called Tapestry at the time, but it was going to be All Ages Comics. And I didn't know much more about it. Basically just said, sounds good, sounds interesting, send me a copy of the contract so I can look it over. Because, you know, you don't say, you want to look at what the deal is. About the next day, or one of the next days, I got on the phone with John Rovnek of Comics Root Up in Vermont, and he said, is it true that you and Boondoggle have gone to Caliber? And I said, huh? Where'd you get that? First of all, I only talked to them. I haven't even seen the contract yet, so nothing's definite. And he didn't mention any of the other names. He just said some other titles. He didn't tell me who else. Apparently, he's already on the net. Was, you know, these stories just get out there.
Right, yes, they do get out there.
And they're buzzing around. You don't know what people know about you.
Well, before we get to phone calls, and you're listening to Nuff Said on WBAI FM 99.5 in New York City, our guest is Scott Roberts, who... writes, pencils, inks, letters, and publishes the comic Patty Cake. And
Among other things.
Yes. Tell us about the letters you've gotten. You seem to get letters from every age group.
Oh, yeah. A lot of them are from adults. One of the most common comments I get is, boy, this makes me feel like I'm a kid again, or I remember doing this and I remember doing that, because a lot of my fans, a lot of the regular readers are adults who appreciate the kind of nostalgic factor in the book. And it's worked to my favor that I've never specified what time it takes place in, because people have a tendency to picture it when they were growing up.
Mm-hmm.
Again, Steve Lieber, he said, you know, it's so accurate to that time period. I said, well, what time period are you talking about, Steve? And he said, well, you know, the 70s when I was growing up. And I said, well, I didn't grow up in the 70s. I thought it was accurate to the time I grew up, which was the 60s.
Yep.
So that's...
Well, the suburbs haven't changed very much, and kids are kids. And
well, I try to have elements of all those decades in there. Anything from the late 50s to the 90s, it's just like the and I do get letters from some kids and drawings from kids.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, at the last Big Apple Con, I was quite pleased to receive a drawing in person from a boy who's about 9, 10, I believe. Philip Spanel was his name, and he came with his father and said he wanted to meet me and give me this drawing, and it's going to be in an upcoming issue. But, you know, so people don't get impatient saying, why didn't you publish my thing? You're always several issues ahead
in what
you send to the printer, so you got to wait a few. You write, and you wait a few issues before the time lapse goes by.
Well, I mentioned we were going to take phone calls soon, and we've already got lines lit up.
Light blinking, yes.
But I'll tell everybody else the phone number. It's 212-279-3400. 212-279-3400.
You're calling him and say, who is this guy, and how long is he getting off?
Yeah, could be. You're on the air.
Yeah, this is Astro. You know, I met a kid today who's going to graduate from the School of Visual Arts. He's studying cartooning there. I saw some of his work, pretty good. But he told me that the Walt Disney Mickey Mouse thing, the copyright's going to expire on that, and everybody's looking to jump in on that. Anybody hear anything about it? It's supposed to expire in a year or two, the copyright for Walt Disney's Mickey Mouse?
Well, they can easily renew
well,
that.
Okay, the trademark is not going to expire. Yeah. So, in other words, you could do a character just like Mickey Mouse and they can't sue you. But you can do a character called Mickey Mouse. Mm. All right? There's a big difference between copyright and trademark. So that's what's going on there.
I see. Thanks.
Okay. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah. You know, based on the listener feedback, I mean, I think definite nomination, Astron Monroe, for schmucks of the year, let alone.
Anyway, come on, do you have anything to say besides that?
No, not at all.
You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
What's up? Well, here's the story. My daughter goes to the School of Visual Arts, and it's kind of ironic given the earlier call, you know, that she got, because the truth is that she has a male friend also who's in a couple of her classes, and this boy essentially was propositioned by Astro to get butt-fucked.
Sorry about that, Scott. Number's 212-279-3400. And you have several vignettes in each comic,
yeah,
rather than a full story, rather than anything continued. Was that a deliberate direction that you were taking?
You call a lot of it instinctive to because, you know, you just kind of, I feel, certain stories just need a certain number of pages. As some things you're just not going to beat a 32-page story out of. Others I've done is a complete 40-page story, the whole issue. It just varies from story to story, whatever seems to demand. And I like the variety. From the beginning, I wanted a variety of pacing so you don't feel like you're reading the same issue over and over.
Well, it's nice that you could just pick up a random issue if you're, you know, in a comic shop and they only have one issue of Patty Cake, you're not going to be in the middle of a continued story.
Yeah.
You're going to get several stories. You're going to get some fake ads,
right,
which are a lot of fun. I think everybody likes fake ads.
Oh, sure.
And
just don't send in for those things.
Well, I think it's pretty obvious what you're doing. But anyway, we'll try you out. You're on the air.
Cloudy buttfuck sheep.
You're on the air.
Astro.
Thanks, Ed. You're on the air.
Hi, I just would like to know, did you say there was something going on this weekend on the Upper West Side?
Yeah.
Yes, there is.
Could you repeat that?
It's this coming Saturday. Well, it's Valentine's Day.
Okay.
What's the name of the church, Scott?
The St. Paul the Apostle Church.
Okay.
And that's on Columbus Avenue between 59th and 60th.
Okay.
The admission is pretty low, and they've got several dozen guests and several dozen comic dealers.
Many dealers.
And it goes on all day.
Okay.
And they usually have food, too.
Yeah,
they have a cafe.
You can meet artists, meet a few writers, pick up some independent comics, or pick up some old stuff.
Pick up collectible stuff.
Yeah.
If you've got the money.
So it's a nice little con.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
We'll be there. Bye.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, it's good to browse through those 50-cent boxes. Find a lot of old gems.
It's amazing. There are several dealers at 50-cent boxes, dollar boxes.
Find stuff from last year that was going to be the hot, valuable item.
Yeah, right. The high value item is now 50 cents. Yeah. Mm. You're on the air.
Yep.
Hi.
Hi. I'm calling from New York City, and I was reading some Patty Cake comics today.
Oh,
and you talk just like her dad. and I'm just thrilled because, like, oh yeah, he's Patty Cake's dad. Okay, yeah, you know.
Well, that makes sense. Yeah, yeah. You are Patty Cake's dad. Yeah,
maybe not as burly, but
I think he's a great dad. I really like him a lot. I think he's a wonderful dad. And he's like, oh, guess what? The pretzel kid was right. There were pretzels. And it's like, yay!
Well, it's interesting also
have a great relationship.
That as I've noticed in reading, you know, I read them in chronological order, you're doing a lot more stories that are not for humorous effect, but for sentimental value.
Yeah, that kind of creeps in as I go along. Well, the first...
It's increased as a gun. It's not just creeped in, right. It's increased.
Well, the first, you know, the father doesn't really look like my dad did. He's not a physical type like he was at all, but obviously bits and pieces of my dad have crept in. Things my dad did or said or just inevitably becoming part of her dad.
Well, yeah, you always sound like your parents, right?
Oh, yeah. So,
yeah, that's scary.
I've been grafting him. If you saw my Christmas issue, I had the little silhouette of my dad in there that kind of shows that they weren't the same type, but they're almost inseparable now.
Hmm. It's also, there's one story you did where Patty stays over with a friend's house.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, the friend's parents...
Oh, that's so scary. Yeah.
Very, but
ooh, and everything's weird.
While I was reading it, I felt as if you were leading into you were going to out and out do a child abuse story. You didn't. You just stopped short of even mentioning child abuse.
Yeah.
But it looked like several times when, you know, like, this is the setup that we're going to talk about at the end of the story.
Well, basically, I wasn't trying to show that it was child abuse, but it does kind of leave it open for the reader to interpret, but... I think at some point in childhood, most people have gone over to a friend's house and they were just shocked at how different everything was. And these are basically parents who just, they don't know how to do right. They're uncultured. They're not like other parents. They're not bad people. They're just completely clueless as to what the social graces are. And there's probably a lot of yelling and screaming, but I don't think there's a lot of hitting in Phoebe's family. It's just... Yeah. Mostly, you know, if she does something wrong, there's going to be a lot of bellowing and stuff.
Did you ever see that stuff that Peter Baggy did when he first started out with that martini gal? And she would go visit the people in the country and they're dead animals under their stove.
Yeah, I've seen some of those. I haven't read them all, but...
They're very strange. Yeah. They're very bizarre artwork, and it's very funny.
Well, my work's been compared to Baggs many times, even though it wasn't meant to be like his. It just... I think we both grew up in Jersey. We don't know each other, but I think we're subject to a lot of the same influences.
Subjected to the influences?
Right. Well, he might have been subjected.
You're the influence.
Yeah, very heavily suburban yes.
Well, some of his influences, I think, also are like Cartoons Magazine and Big Daddy Roth, which doesn't really figure into my work, but, you know, just the real cartoony splat type exaggeration, I think, you know, it's just...
It gets a lot more emotion to the picture, you know, the tape, you know.
Well, it's...
Those are fun.
Well, it's that exaggerated kid's point of view. Everything is bigger and much more important to a kid than it really is to an adult. So,
things are crisis. Yeah,
everything's a crisis.
Yeah, everything's
and when the eyes start to tear up and dribble, it's so funny. You draw that so well with the quivering lips. And her dad just goes, don't do that.
Or it eventually melts him, too.
Yes, and then he goes,
Yeah, one minute the dad's being very fierce and disciplinarian, and the next minute he's just a total softy. Which I guess is dads, you know, or some dads.
Well, I did kind of sneak in a childhood fantasy of my mom's, too, with the dad, because I got the whole thing about dreaming you're in a giant's pocket. I borrowed that from my mom. She didn't really picture it in her dad's pocket, but I just thought it was a natural for Patty Cake that he would be the giant.
Oh, that's funny.
But I always thought there was such an appealing, cozy kind of fantasy to have as a kid, that you're running around in a giant's shirt pocket. So it was inevitable that would show up, too.
And the number here is 212-279-3400. You want to stay on the air?
Sure, why not? Okay. I can talk about comics.
We'll bring in some other folks. You're on the air.
As long as they don't talk about that stuff.
You're on the air.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Yes, this question is to Scott Roberts.
Yes.
Now,
thank you.
What was your favorite comic strip or comic book?
Well, the overall favorite comic strip was, when I was a kid, was Peanuts. I mean, that was, to me, the greatest thing anybody could do with their life was create something like Peanuts. And I loved it. And I even loved the Dell comic book version, which wasn't done by Schultz, but it was done in his studio under his supervision by friends of his, actually.
Those are the only Peanuts cartoons not done by Schultz.
It's the only officially sanctioned Peanuts, but they were done under his watchful eye because the cartoons who worked on them were people that he knew and was trying to get some work for.
I never knew that.
He's revealed more information about it recently.
Okay.
Some of it, if you see the new Comics Journal issue 200. There's like a 50-page interview with Schultz, and they ask about the Dell Comics. You know.
Mm-hmm.
And I've gotten another name from some other people who said Dale Hale was the name of one of the guys who worked.
Mm-hmm.
So those things, yeah, a lot of the humor. Dennis the Menace was a big favorite as a kid. And I also collected Batman, especially around the time the show was on, although it wasn't hard to see the difference between the comics
yeah,
and the show.
Right.
And Mad, big favorite was Mad Magazine, just because it was so wild and warped. Unfortunately, I was too young for the Harvey Kurtzman comic book version, but when I did finally see some of those, they really bent my mind.
Oh, okay.
When I saw the way Harvey Kurtzman drew, it's become like a permanent influence on me, just to know that people could draw like that, because it was different from what anybody else was doing.
Okay, it's really good to see that there are comic books of that type that's still in the market, because, I mean, I don't see a whole lot of them, and maybe it's where I'm looking, but, I mean, I grew up with Harvey,
yeah.
I mean, I used to read my share of Richie Rich's and Dennis the Menace's, and I was just wondering if there's still a market for more.
I'm trying to find out if there is by doing this book.
Okay.
I'm out there feeling it out and seeing, is there a market for it?
Okay.
Oddly enough, I collect the old Little Audreys. It sounds like, you know, what's an adult guy doing collecting books about a little girl? But it's just the kid angle. I mean, Richie Rich was a little harder for me to relate to because I wasn't rich.
He's a billionaire.
Yeah. At least Little Audrey was normal suburban kids. Mm. She had her buddy Melvin and all.
And Little Dot. I like Little Dot. Yeah. I thought she was interesting.
I always wondered how many stories they could get out of being fascinated by dots. But
right.
But, you know, your comment about, you know, maybe it's where you're looking. I think it's really hard to look anywhere that does have anything like this.
Yeah.
Which is why I had Scott give the address, and we'll give it again at the end of the show, and encourage people to go to conventions where you meet the creators. But there are comic shops that have this stuff, and boy, they deserve being supported.
Yeah, well, if you,
I agree.
If you visit Jim Hanley's here in the city on 33rd Street, they have one of the widest varieties of comics
yeah,
you're going to find.
Mm-hmm.
They try to carry just about everything that comes out. Just walk around the racks. It's all in alphabetical order, and you'll discover all kinds of stuff.
And they're not going to scream at you if you have to actually open it up and look at it.
Uh-huh.
You know, you're allowed to look to see if you want to buy it or
not. Yeah, I've been in a couple of shops where the burly bodyguards are saying, oh, don't try to open the bags.
Yeah.
Don't look in there. Your eyes will fall out.
Yeah.
Okay. It won't be mint anymore.
You touched it. You breathed on it.
You got your eye prints all over it.
Oh, yeah, I love it. Eye prints.
Okay.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you.
All right, bye.
Thank you. What about Sugar and Spike? Have you ever seen them?
I hadn't heard of it, but I had never really seen it until one of my readers sent me a copy and some Xeroxes of some other stuff because he was a big fan and thought there was a bridge between. So, yeah, you know, it was kind of interesting to after hearing of it.
No, but I'm saying that people who enjoy Sugar and Spike should check out your stuff because
they
think they find a lot of the same fun.
Yeah,
the feeling of just racing along and it's funny. You know, nobody's going to really get hurt. Which I enjoy that in comics. I don't like when people get hurt in comics. You know?
Well, there's no guns, no violence in Patty Cake.
Yeah. And
I know, there's moments. Violence. People are throwing snowballs at each other.
Yeah.
And, you know,
ice balls.
I like it when she made him eat grass.
Oh, yeah.
She made him eat a grass milkshake.
Well, I still feel guilty, but my brother and I kind of once fixed somebody at a duck pond like that, but we kind of put some dirt in their milkshake or something, but I feel
kids are cruel, and you don't hide that fact in the kids you've got. So I don't know about the no violence. It's just there's no guns.
Yeah, well, there's no permanently damaging violence.
Well, I mean, I think I see some kind of, you know, if you like The Simpsons or Ren and Stimpy, there's a lot of things going in there that are...
A lot of the letter writers are talk about Ren and Stimpy.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I guess there's some element of that. Except
when I first saw Ren and Stimpy, it to me kind of liberated me because I thought, I can draw wild and cartoony and exaggerated. There is a market for this.
People like it, yeah. People get it.
I tried to repress that for a long time. When I was trying to sell comic strips, I wasn't drawing them the way I'm drawing Patty Cake because I thought, well, nobody would take that. That's, you know, too crazy, and it amuses me. But in the newspapers, you seem to have to play it subtle.
Yeah.
And really play it down. So I was trying to do the Gary Trudeau type thing. There'd be with the droopy eyelids.
Maybe you should have tried it. Maybe that would have worked.
Who knows?
Maybe
now.
It's worth trying now. I mean,
well,
you never know.
Maybe it should be done as animation rather than, you know, trying to do it as a strip.
Well, I was briefly optioned for a while, like everybody is in the comic book market, but most of them, nothing came of it.
Yeah, right.
I mean, the options are flying.
Let's try a couple more calls.
Mm-hmm.
You're on the air.
Astro, don't.
Boy, some people.
You're on the air too.
The crank calls, aren't
they?
It's this time of night, I think, and it's like Sunday.
Shoot them all! Shoot them all!
Oh, yeah.
The ray gun.
They're willing to sit there for the whole show trying to get their crank
yeah,
calls.
Yeah, yeah. Those two people were waiting quite
zap,
a while.
Zap, zap, zap.
Yeah.
Let's use the zapper and the clapper on them.
Yeah. You're on the air.
Yeah, this is Astro.
He keeps introducing himself.
You're on the air.
Astro.
Boy.
Got a fast dial.
Yeah,
he must be on speed dial.
Young man, use that finger to pick your ears.
Astro.
Who knows what they use their finger
for. You eat with that mouth?
Yeah.
Well, why don't you give the address to get patty cake for those who can't make it to the convention next week?
Why don't you write to Post Office Box 546. Monsey, M-O-N-S-E-Y, New York, 10952. Write to me. I'll check my box.
Scott Roberts.
Yes, Scott Roberts.
That's right.
Care of patty cake, if you like, but as long as well, my name's on there somewhere.
How do you establish a price for your comics? Since you self-published, how did you figure out what you were going to charge?
Well, at the time, it was the average price for a black and white 32-page comic. It's just most of the ones.
So you basically use what everybody else was charging.
Market price.
Right. You just try to. I remember I was doing a signing with somebody else doing a book saying, you know, if the sales are good and if we get a good response, we'll lower the price in the next book. And the retailer in the shop right away said, don't do that. That's a mistake. Mm-hmm. Never put it out for one price and then lower the price because then people say, well, what's wrong with it then? If it was worth, you know, so-and-so 1 month, why is it worth less now? Which is sort of why the 99-cent comic experiment kind of blew up in the faces of both Marvel and Caliber. They both tried it. Because, yeah, all of a sudden, selected books are 99 cents. People say, well, why aren't they...
What's wrong with it?
Yeah.
It's broken.
Yeah.
It must be defaulty.
It's like everybody complains about the price, and then you give them a lower price, and then your perceived market value has been set in your
head. Yeah, that's true. Once you get started on the new price...
It's degrading.
But, I mean, it is amazing how expensive comics are.
Okay, well, John Workman, in his essay on comics, if you read it in the Comics Journal, points out that comics kind of did a lot of irreparable damage to themselves by holding the price down as long as they did, because they stayed 10 cents when every other periodical on the stands were going up, and this made them look like, you know, well, what is this cheap stuff that's only 10 cents? And to the retailer, that meant a very slim profit.
Right,
why give that limited shelf space to this 10-cent comic when I'll make more money off Time or Life or any other magazine I put out there?
Yeah, but those take up the same amount of shelf space.
So for them to finally start going up, all of a sudden it looks like, what are these astronomical leaps? Trying to keep up with the rest of the periodicals now, but it just was leapfrogging up because it had stayed low for so long. But I try to pack my book at least with enough value. So you
yeah.
Get your money's worth.
And we're coming up to the end of the show. We got Orpo Martin pacing the hallway outside. Waiting to come in and do his show.
Fingernails are
which
fine.
Is coming up right next.
So we're sorry we couldn't get to the crank calls who were holding, but...
I'm sure it was Astro Boy again.
Oh, yeah. They're blinking away, and he's saying, well, why don't they put me on the air so I can make a fool of myself?
He has to dial with one hand.
Yeah, it's funny with right after Pledge Weeks is when we get the most crank calls, and then they start to die down. As soon as it's membership drive again, they start to increase. It seems to be a very strange cycle.
And then they run around and tell all their friends, I got on the air.
I think it's the full moon, actually. Isn't there a full moon today?
Yeah, it happens every pledge drive. Full moon or not.
They get upset because during the pledge drive, they can't call in and get on the air.
Yeah, well, so they do crank calls to the people taking calls.
So anyway, our Paul is on his way into the studio, and we're on our way out of here.
Yeah, I want to thank our guest, Scott Roberts. And... let's see, next week will be the Ring of Nibelung, so we'll be preempted. And the week after that, we'll be back.
And what do we have planned for that?
The week after that, I'm not sure. I've got two people that I'm trying to see if they're going to still be in town.
Uh-huh.
There's a couple out-of-town guests that I'm looking for. And, boy, if they're on, it's going to be great.
Okay, so anyway, see you in 2 weeks then. If you want to send
me. And the weekend, I should mention the end of the month.
The end of the
last
month.
Last weekend of the, I guess it's March 1st, will be Jeff Krell, whose comic strip Jason is being turned into a musical this June.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So if you want to send an email, enough said, is at WBAI, 505 8th Avenue, New York, New York, 10018. And email is enoughsaid@escape.com. Hopefully I'll get my premium from the computer, personal computer show, and I'll be able to put up a web page soon. So until then, we'll see you in 2 weeks. Bye.